This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
June's Journey is a fascinating hidden object mystery gaming app where you'll play as June Parker, tasked with a daunting obligation: solve your sister's murder. Set in the 1920s, the era of glitz and glam, this family mystery is one for the ages. Everyone's a suspect until your investigation determines otherwise. The clues are all around you, hidden within tricky twists and turns. You'll collect detailed information about each character in your photo album, where you'll comb over every detail. You can even join a detectives club to chat and play with others or against them in the detectives league. With hundreds of puzzles to solve, you should probably get started today. Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here with a special additional episode of Eye on Travel. We broadcast from the West Indies and the island of Nevis in the Four Seasons Resort. This is a show we taped just before the pandemic. I'll be talking with Helen Russell, the author of The Atlas of Happiness. What a better time to talk about the pursuit of happiness and what it exactly means for a nation to be happy. Then Susan Gordon, who left Philadelphia for Nevis 23 years ago, tells me about the history of Nevis's sugar mills and what that has to teach us about the island itself and its special architecture. Coincidentally, she's also the author of Searching for Sugar Mills. And then, a fascinating look at the unique and surprising relationship of Alexander Hamilton and Nevis. There's all this and more as Eye on Travel broadcasts from the Four Seasons Resort in Nevis in the West Indies. Minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here as Eye on Travel continues from the Four Seasons Resort right here on Nevis in the West Indies. You know, it's interesting when you start to talk to people who made a choice in their life to just pick up and move. And it's not a question of going from like Chicago to, you know, to Indiana. It's a question of going from Philadelphia to basically Nevis. And that's my next guest, Suzanne Gordon, who's one of the great volunteers here in historic preservation. You run a real estate firm here, but you were at the Philadelphia Inquirer for how long?
I was at the Inquirer for 18 years and then newspapers in Philly for about 30 years before I moved
when
here.
When newspapers were really newspapers.
They were great. It was a great time to be working there.
What brought you here?
Well, I was turning 50 and I decided I wanted to do something different. So I applied to the Peace Corps and one thing happened. I couldn't sell my house. So then I came on an architectural project to Nevis, a volunteer vacation. I got to be friends with a lady who is now an architect here and we got this crazy idea to write a book about Caribbean architecture.
And the name is Searching for Sugar Mills.
Searching for Sugar Mills.
Because sugar mills were so big at one point.
Oh, yeah. And
it was actually the economy.
Right. Key to the economy and still are an extremely important part of Nevis.
So have you found some sugar mills?
Oh, yeah. There's tons of them here. There were 41 mills. A lot of them are hidden up in the hills and you can't even see them now. The ones that have gotten into private hands are the ones that are best preserved. And we have several private homes, not to mention a couple are for sale, and that are sugar mills. And we also have some great plantation inns, Golden Rock, which is a stunning property, as well as Montpelier. You can stay in Golden Rock in the mill. It's a honeymoon suite. You can dine in the mill at Montpelier. They're a very important part of the sense of place of Nevis. Nevis is all about the sugar history.
Well, sugar at one point was your gold, wasn't it?
Exactly, it was. And you know, at one point, as Evelyn mentioned, the people got you know, the British made more money off of Neva sugar than anywhere else in the world, and we produced more than Jamaica did at one point in time.
And then what happened?
Well, various things happened. The sugar beet came online. The use of sugar waned a bit. There was a lot of other areas, tropical areas, that started growing sugar, and it eventually just died out.
Replaced by what?
Well, tourism. But there was a huge period of time in between when tourism began and the sugar ended. You know, of course, I wasn't here, and probably many of us were not, but apparently it was a very difficult time on Nevis.
At that point, it was probably a welfare state.
Practically. A lot of people left. I mean, a lot of people, my understanding is a lot of people went and worked on the Panama Canal. A lot of men left. If you go to any of the Virgin Islands, you'll meet a lot of people from Nevis who are working up there still. So there was this diaspora of Nevisions and Catichans throughout the world.
And then tourism came in.
Tourism came in. There was a little bit of tourism early in the 70s and 80s. We had, and then in 1991, of course, this wonderful property opened, and it just changed everything.
This is the one that turned it around,
the Four Seasons Resort.
And the Four Seasons has been here for 29 years.
It has been, yeah.
And you've been here for 23.
Yes, right. So, and I also came in the 70s, so I saw this beach and this property when it was just all coconuts. But this company really changed the face of Nevis, and people learned tourism and how to work in tourism.
Okay, so I know why you came. Mm-hmm. Why did you stay?
Because I love it. I mean, it's a fantastic...
But what keeps you here?
Well, I started a business, and my business has been successful. I have a lot of friends here. I love the weather. I will never, ever step foot in the snow or cold ever again in my life, unless my life depends on it for some reason. You know, it's just a wonderful place to live. It's like living in a small town.
Well, it is a small town.
It is a small town, and it's like a third of the size of the county I lived in when I lived back in Philadelphia. So everyone knows everyone. Everyone cares about everyone. They take, you know, very good care of their neighbors and friends, and it's a wonderful community, and I've met just amazing people here.
You talk about the weather. People tend to just live outside here.
Totally, yeah. I mean, you just don't even have windows most of the time. You just have screens or louvers or lattice shutters or shutters. You don't, and that's great because people just don't get sick very much here because you're always in the open air.
And you have some storms.
Yeah, we do. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're exciting. Good reason to drink rum.
So basically, your name is any excuse to drink rum.
No.
But you know, being an American expat, I can call you that, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about this forever because I talk to all the American expats wherever we go for the show.
Right.
And I always ask them, okay, the minute you get there, your friends back home, first of all, think you're nuts. Mm-hmm. And then they start to come to visit. They come to see you.
Some do.
And what happens when they get here?
Well, some finally get it. You know, like, oh, I understand why you moved here. You know, and I understand why you stay. A lot of people just have trouble taking risks. And I know I was accused of being absolutely stupid when I decided to leave my great job at the Inquirer to move here. But, you know, and one guy even figured out how much I was going to lose in my 401k for the next 20 years and gave me this printout. And I'm like, okay.
Okay, and where is he today?
He's working hard.
He's working hard. Stick with us. We'll be right back with more from Suzanne Gordon and her book. And we're going to talk more about the architecture as well. Right back after this. Mm-hmm. 52 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here as we return to the Four Seasons here in Nevis. As Ion Travel continues, we've been speaking to Suzanne Gordon, the author of Searching for Sugar Mills, an architectural guide to the Eastern Caribbean. And, you know, you mentioned so many sugar mills, but it's more than the architecture of the sugar mills, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's the whole plantation system, and it's all of the architecture that makes Nevis what it is. And we have a very interesting history of housing here. And each island has its own type of vernacular housing. But, you know, here they have wonderful fretwork. You have big verandas. You have these homes that are called the skirt and blouse, which is a stone foundation and a wooden top. Skirt and blouse. So you've got the stone skirt on the bottom, and then the second floor is the blouse. And typically people would have like a shop downstairs, and then they would live upstairs where, you know, the breezes came through, the windows were open, and they had the high hip roof ceilings to let the air and the heat rise and the air blow through. So,
what would traditionally define Caribbean architecture? What would you say?
I would say buildings that allow people to live comfortably and sleep comfortably in times without air conditioning, and you know, taking advantage of the airflow and not, you know, not face the storms. You know, keep the back of the house towards the northeast where the weather comes in. Protect from rain. So it's logical stuff.
Now, since you're an American, do you have air conditioning?
No, I have no air conditioning.
See, you're not an American anymore.
No, I'm not. Not a real one.
Did you ever have it?
No, not on Nevis, no.
So you really are the rebel.
Yes.
From an architectural perspective, obviously you did the book. When people come here, what's a surprise to them about the architecture?
I think the fact that it's very authentic. People appreciate seeing things that are different. One of the things about the sense of place that the architecture provides for Nevis is that it's different from everywhere else in the world. I mean, anywhere you go in the States, you could go, you know, down to the mall and you see a Target and you see a Walmart and everything looks the same. But when people come here, they're looking for things that look different. And I think they're very pleased and very surprised at how unusual the architecture is here and the buildings and the whole feel of the place. It's not like home. And that's the way we really need to keep it, so that people want to come here. You don't go to Italy to see Walmart. You go to Italy to see churches and cathedrals and wonderful bridges.
Although so many Americans, their idea of an adventure trip is to go to an American-branded hotel overseas and order a cheeseburger and think they've roughed it.
That's right. That's right. But for the people who really appreciate Nevis, they get out, they hike. I mean, the hiking here is phenomenal. They go up the waterfalls.
Tell me about the hiking.
Well, we have the ultimate hike is to go to the peak, which is, of course, 32 feet high. It's very challenging, but a lot of people love to do it.
Have you done it?
I have not.
You've been here 23 years?
No, I've hiked Mount La Amiga, which is called Mount Misery, over on St. Kitts, which was not too difficult. I haven't, no. But if anybody...
So you hiked Mount Baby.
Mount Baby, yeah. It was not too hard. But then there's the water source. You can hike up to that from Golden Rock. And there's waterfalls. And there's just lots of walks. People walk. We have a thing called the Upper Round Road, which used to connect the sugar plantations like midway up the mountain. And people walk from Golden Rock to Hermitage. And, you know... But we do recommend always that if anybody goes to the peak, they go with a guide. Because once in a while, someone will get lost, and it's best to have a knowledgeable guide with you.
And when will your next peak climb?
I don't know. I'm thinking about it
for 23 years. All right. But it's all about the preservation, too.
Right.
Right? And so much development in any country of the world usually doesn't really take into account preservation, because it's conflicting with progress. So how have you been able to maintain that strength of preservation here?
Well, part of it has happened really because of a lack of money. I mean, places that aren't like super rich tend to have more old places than places that are very rich. If you don't have this overall awareness that things have to be preserved. So part of it is that there really hasn't been a lot of money to change things, which is in a sense a good thing. So... And then the other thing is, I think people do here have an appreciation of, you know, keeping things as they were and keeping them authentic. And things can be modernized without being changed on the exterior. And there's been a real awareness of not building higher than a coconut tree, not changing the scale of the town of Charlestown. You want everything to be like two stories.
So there's not really a building code, but people have actually respected that, though.
There has been a great deal of respect for that, yes. And we don't have any buildings around the island more than three stories. And no one has made any effort to do high rises. I mean, it just wouldn't work here.
Exactly. And people can get involved and volunteer.
Yes.
How can they do that?
Well, many ways. I mean, we have the Nevis Historical and Conservation Society, and we have lots of events. We have research projects. We have groups that come in, and lots of archaeologists come and from different academic universities around the world and do studies here. People can volunteer for that. We have different work projects. You know,
and the beautiful thing about all of that is we're not talking about a 40-mile drive to get there.
No, no.
It's all manageable.
Right. It's very easy. I mean, the farthest you can go here is like 10.5 miles. You go one way,
10.5.
Or you go 10.5 the other way. It's like when you're going around the island, you have to decide which way you're going to go.
Can I quote you on that?
Sure.
That's like saying no matter where you're going, there you are.
There you are, right.
Suzanne Gordon, author of Searching for Sugar Mills, an architectural guide to the Eastern Caribbean. And thank you so much for joining us. That music means we're out of time for this hour. Stick around, everybody. We have a whole lot more coming from the Four Seasons Resort right here in Nevis as Ion Travel returns right after this. She's a British journalist, best-selling author and speaker, but she's also the author of a book that I encourage you all to get. It's called The Atlas of Happiness. Helen Russell, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Well, good. By the way, I think this is a book that is much needed and will be very helpful. But I love the idea of the research, because you started this research almost 8 years ago trying to figure out, you know, who's happy, but most importantly, why they're happy.
Yeah, that's right. So I was living and working in London as a journalist for 12 years, and I had no intention of leaving until my husband was offered his dream job working for Lego in rural Denmark. And Denmark at the time, as your listeners will know, had just been voted the happiest country in the world. And I became fascinated by this. I was pretty burnt out at the time, as many people working in cities are. We'd also been trying to start a family for years with years of fertility treatment, but nothing ever worked. We were so tired and stressed. So suddenly this other life possibility was dangled in front of us. And so we kind of thought, well, if we can't get happy there, where could we? So I decided to give it a year. And I thought, well, maybe I'll test every area of Danish living, speak to as many politicians and experts and psychologists and sociologists as I could to find out why Denmark was so happy. And that was my starting off point, really.
All right, let's start in Denmark. I mean, why are the Danes so happy?
Well, I mean, they do have this great social welfare system. We do pay the taxes that fund it. But there's also the really high levels of trust in Denmark. There's high levels of national pride. And there's also the word that listeners will be now familiar with, this hygge, this idea of coziness and of prioritizing time together that's really important to Danes. They also have the word that I love is arbejdsglæde, from arbejder, the Danish for work, and glæde, the word for happiness. It literally means happiness at work, something that is prioritized in Denmark. And since most of us spend most of our time working, more time working than we do with friends and family, it seems like a pretty good idea, pretty important to like your work, like your colleagues, find a way to make that pleasurable or at least worthwhile. So I think that helps a lot for Danes.
Well, I love the idea that the name of your first book was The Year of Living Danishly. I love it.
Thank you.
But here's my question. When you talk about coziness, is it a safe assumption that the coziest the country, the happier the country?
That's interesting. Well, there are a few similar words to hygge around the world. The Scandinavian countries each tend to have their own. There's mus in Sweden. Even in the Netherlands, there's a very similar word. In Germany, there's a similar term with all slight cultural variations. I'm sure there is something to do with trust. If you have the headspace not being anxious all the time, then you can be happier. If you trust the people around you, Danes trust each other so much, they're happy to let their baby sleep outside in strollers while they pop into a cafe for lunch.
You realize, of course, that if we do that in the United States, you're arrested for child endangerment.
I know, and I actually ended up in email correspondence with the Dane who famously experienced this the hard way. But yeah, it's totally normal here. And it just was just as strange for me coming from London, where, you know, you lock your door, you lock everything. But here there is this sense that because everybody contributes, that everybody participates, you're all in it together. So you kind of trust your neighbors and even strangers.
All right. So Denmark was the starting point, but it's certainly not the end point. Let's talk about some other countries. I'll start with the A's, Australia.
Yeah, so in Australia, it's such bad news at the moment, but this idea that fair go is a really, and it doesn't quite sound right in a British accent, but fair go is my best Australian effort. This idea that as long as you are giving something your best shot, whether it's on the sporting field, whether it's meeting new people, it's this idea that you don't have to be the best at something, but you have to participate. You have to give everybody a fair chance. And as someone growing up in the UK, where if you weren't good at sport at school, you were a social leper for a little while. And also it just meant that you just didn't play sport. And that seemed like a very different way of approaching it, where you're just, the reward is for participating. And there are lots of studies into psychology and well-being that show that being a part of something, being part of a team, gives you a great sense of belonging, gives you lots of physical and mental benefits. So that seemed like a really positive way to approach life that I thought we could actually all learn from. It's a very down-to-earth, kind of salty at times approach to happiness and to living a good life.
Now, there's the other way of doing this on a converse level. Also reminds me of a phrase in Australia, right? No worries.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, which has sort of been taken up, and I write about this as well, by, you know, in the US and in Canada and to an extent in the UK as well. It's this idea that life's a beach, even though a lot of Australians do not live near a beach, but there is an awful lot of water. And there's this idea that you are spending a lot of your time outside. You have to get on with your neighbours, is cultivating this kind of no worries mentality, which is very different to the idea of life that I grew up with and that many people grew up with, especially growing up in cities or in cultures where there's a lot more pressure to succeed, perhaps, or a lot more competition. This idea that you start from a fair kind of place where everyone is equal and it's no worries. You're just going to make friends with strangers. You're going to have really easy interpersonal relationships. Whereas in the UK and Denmark, certainly, you have to be introduced by at least two family members before you can even consider smiling and talking to a stranger. But in Australia, it's this real kind of hospitality and this generosity of spirit, which I found really inspiring.
You know, as you go from country to country, each country, or I should say each culture, has a specific definition of happiness, which may or may not jive with our own. But one that has always fascinated me is Japan.
Yeah, me too. And certainly I've traveled there about 10 years ago for work. And then I had the opportunity to go there again to work recently. And just this idea. So in Japan, they have wabi-sabi, this idea of the beauty of imperfection and transience and the fact that the nature and the natural world is not perfect. There will be knobbly trees and there will be moss and there will be mold, but there is a beauty in that. And there is a beauty that comes with age and wisdom, which I think certainly in your culture and mine, there is this emphasis on the new all the time, the emphasis on the shiny. But actually in Japan, there is value to things having an age and being a bit even broken at times, which feels like something it's very helpful to bear in mind. I career towards my 40th birthday right now. As a woman especially, it's really helpful to get this idea that with age comes wisdom and that it's a positive thing. And our laughter lines and our cracks and our scars, because we all have scars of one kind or another, are to be valued. They're what make us who we are and worthwhile. And in Japan, they also have this amazing, the ancient art of kintsugi, which is repairing broken ceramics with metallic lacquer so that the scars and the cracks, instead of being concealed, they are highlighted in pure gold. And the beauty is because of the imperfection, not in spite of it. So I just found that incredibly inspiring. And, you know, walking around Tokyo for work a couple of years ago, it was just a real sense of, although it's a country with many challenges and it's not a particularly happy country, but there are people who are finding meaning in life and finding a really positive way to live by embracing some of these traditional principles.
I should tell you, Helen, that given the Japanese model, I looked in the mirror and I had a choice between beauty and wisdom. I went immediately for wisdom because beauty was just not going to work.
This is radio, but I'm sure you have both in spades, Peter.
Oh, stop. That's sucking up in the worst way. But bottom line, you know, when you're in that part of the world, the definition of happiness in Japan is completely contrasted with the definition of happiness in China.
Yeah, and China is a really interesting one because in China, there's this concept of Xing Fu, which is often translated as a good mood, but actually, or just happiness, but actually refers not to a good mood, but a good life. And it's one that may include pain and suffering and challenges. In fact, the Chinese character for Xing actually represents torture. So, you know, you get the idea. Life's not going to be a bed of roses, but it will be meaningful. It will be worthwhile. So in China, people will pursue their Xing Fu, their calling, their meaning in life. And this feels like a really valuable thing to bear in mind as we enter a new work year, that sometimes things will feel hard and there are huge social and political and economic challenges that many of us face. And sometimes work doesn't feel fun and sometimes family life can be incredibly challenging.
You're right.
If our life has a meaning, then it's worthwhile.
Helen, we were just at the break. We were talking about the cultural differences in definition between, let's say, the Chinese and the Japanese. But one of the countries that has always fascinated me as well in terms of their approach to, well, not just happiness but well-being, is Portugal. You go to the Alfama district and everybody's singing in fado, and that sort of singing. It people have said to me, "Oh, it's sad. It's so sad, and people are so sad when they sing the song." But then somebody explained to me that the singing of the song itself is about the pursuit of the getting away from melancholy.
Yes, this is a really interesting one. So the fado and part of that music is sudagi, this Portuguese term that represents a feeling of longing and melancholy or nostalgia for a happiness that once was, even a happiness that you merely hoped for that perhaps didn't materialize. So it is sad, but it's in a way that perhaps if we look through old photographs, we might feel that sort of bittersweet feeling when we reminisce, or if you think of someone fondly who's perhaps not in your life anymore. So it's a really valuable sort of pleasure pain. And I think there are lots of studies from psychologists showing that allowing ourselves this temporary sadness counterintuitively makes us happier by stimulating neural pathways, by encouraging us to be more grateful for what we've got. So in Portugal and Brazil, to an even greater extent, they even have Dia de Saudade on the 30th of January each year. They have a whole day centered around playing fado music on the radio and people sharing poems. It's this idea that you should celebrate lost love just as much as you should love that is still there, and that happiness that has passed is still of value. So yeah, it's this idea that you can be sad, and being sad will actually help you be happier in the long run.
Well, in America, you see, we do it a different way. We don't celebrate lost love. We celebrate former restraining orders.
That's so romantic. But it's interesting. So Germany also has something along these lines. So they have Gemütlichkeit, which is often thought of a bit like the Danish Hygge around coziness. But actually in Germany, they're very strict on the idea that you can get Gemütlichkeit, you can get cozy, but only once you've done your day of work. So you may not enjoy work, but then you get the reward. And in German culture, there is this idea of hard work and knuckling down. So you've probably heard of it. The German wedding celebrations often kick off with a custom called Polterabend, which is smashing porcelain, and they're making the happy couple sweep up the shaft. Or they will saw a log of wood together, and that's meant to present the hard work that marriage involves, or that sometimes there will be pain and sometimes there will be sorrow and it will be difficult at times. And I just think that that's a really refreshing way of looking at it, having been with my husband for about 10 years now. Nobody warns you often at the wedding that things aren't always going to be sunny and there will be tough times. And I feel like in the US and the UK, we are perhaps not as well equipped to handle the tough times because there's such an emphasis on pursuing the jazz hands happy all the time. And I think other cultures do that a lot better than us, so we can really learn from them.
Well, then there's the other idea of some countries more formalizing the concept of happiness, sort of like the gross national happiness quotient. I think of a country or a kingdom of like Bhutan.
Yes, and Bhutan is a fascinating idea. So the gross national happiness, measuring that instead of gross national product. And the idea had been in place throughout Bhutanese history, but was formalized in 1972 when King Wanchuk IV told a journalist in the Financial Times, of all people, that gross national happiness was more important than gross national product. And now they measure it and they prioritize it ahead of financial gain. And it's that last bit that's the crucial thing, because we can all decide, we want to be happier. But actually, I talk all around the world about Scandinavia and the happiness model and different cultures. And many people I speak to say, well, I'd love, all of that happiness and all that great welfare state, but I don't really want to pay the taxes that correspond with it. And in Bhutan, they've made it very clear. They've made that decision that they're putting happiness first. So they'll measure and prioritize this. They said no to joining the World Trade Organization because doing so would have meant opening up their forests in a way that wasn't compatible with their goals for the environment. They said no to McDonald's and their cash. There's this idea that they're one of the few developing countries putting sustainability at the heart of their government plans, and it has made people happier. They record the whole population every couple of years. Life expectancy has doubled. Education is now universal. People are happier. So it's really fascinating, of course, on a small scale, but you can see that these measures really do make a difference. And the EU was trying to implement a lot of these ideas from around 2011. Ban Ki-moon is really keen on the idea. But it hasn't quite caught on in the rest of the world yet. But they are a really fascinating country, to keep an eye on.
We're talking to Helen Russell, the author of The Atlas of Happiness. I can't let you go without asking you, other than Denmark, what's the one place in the world that makes you the happiest?
Oh, great question. Iceland. I traveled to Iceland before I had ever been to any other countries, in the Nordic countries or any of the other Viking nations. And I found it so fascinating, sitting in the Blue Lagoon with sort of geysers exploding in the background. You cannot fail to be overawed by that. And the Icelanders have this idea of tataradost, or it will all work out. And they just have this utter confidence. I love the Viking spirit that you find in Iceland, this idea that even though the landscape is so inhospitable and the climate is so brutal, that they even have ad hoc solar free or sun holidays. If there's an Icelandic heat wave of over, 18 degrees Celsius, I'm not quite sure the Fahrenheit, but even in summer, the weather is so abysmal that they just keep going, and they're really creative and they produce this great art. So Iceland has a special place in my heart.
Helen Russell, the author of a good book and a great book, a book that'll make you happy, or at least send you in the right direction. The book, The Atlas of Happiness. Helen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Peter.
After the hour, it's Peter Greenberg here with you from the island of Nevis and the Four Seasons Resort as we continue Ion Travel. Joining me now is someone who I can call her a local. She was born on St. Kitts but raised everywhere else and now in Nevis. She was at the United Nations for a number of years, and now she's the historian, but most importantly, the head of the World Heritage Committee for Nevis. Evelyn Henville, how are you?
I am fine. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You know, when we talk about history, the first name that comes up is not someone from Nevis, it's Alexander Hamilton.
Yes, that's the son of our soil. And Alexander Hamilton is what has driven us and given us our name on the international scene, have been his birthplace. We have garnered quite a lot in terms of our notoriety because of him. And he, too, gained a lot from us for his short little 9 years that he spent on Nevis.
But what's the St. Croix connection?
Well, he moved to the family moved to St. Croix.
Ah.
And from St. Croix, then off to New York. So he left St. Croix at age of 14 for the U.S.
But
mainland. He was born on Nevis.
Yeah.
He also, the recent history has been telling us that through author Michael Newton's research, that he also spent a couple of years on St. Bart's.
So he got around.
Yes.
Now, if I go to the island of St. Helena in the middle of the Atlantic, I'll see Napoleon's house. What's left of Alexander Hamilton in Nevis?
Well, actually, very little, except the land. And the remains of his home, which was considered his family's home, the remains that were left here in the 1700s were in 1970s, in the 70s.
Oh, that's what was left.
The remaining were the steps of what was thought to be the family's home. And through independence, our countries gained independence in 1983, and the U.S. government, through USAID, assisted with a donation of $1 million to get the house rebuilt. And so we have that now, which forms our Alexander Hamilton Museum of Nevis history. And also upstairs, it serves our parliamentary sittings. So that house is in Charlestown, and that is the compound. All of the land on that area were considered his mother's property, and there is another house on the side near the museum, which was also considered the family home as well. The foundation of it is still there, but the house itself has been owned over time by numerous families, and that too forms part of the museum today.
What's the story that you tell about him?
The story that we tell about him is that, one, yes, he left here at 9. However, how he became and what he became were derived from his years here. He and his years on St. Croix, his years of getting into economy, the financial market.
At the age of nine?
At the age of being able to, because where his home, where the home, the family home is right on the waterfront where the slaves used to be deposited for sale. So he experienced all of that at nine. Also, the economy of Nevis during that time, going back 100 years before him, it was booming. The economy on Nevis paid the most to the crown, to the British crown, in taxes for almost 100 years.
So he not only saw the slave trade, he saw what needed to be done for the ocean.
Correct, he did. He was the one who created the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard was developed in his design, mental design, was to protect the oceans, one, to protect the financial systems in New York from the British, and also to protect the seas from bringing in any more countries, bringing in any more slaves and selling more slaves.
Now, UNESCO has been here.
Yes.
And now you've got some stuff going on with them.
Yes. We have been nominated and won the nomination to be St. Kitts Nevis on the prestigious World Heritage Committee. We were voted on. There were only 21 member states. And we, being one of the smallest islands, we were nominated in 2017.
And you can still go see where he hung out.
Yes.
Evelyn yes. Henville of the World Heritage Committee for Nevis.
Yes. Nevis and Kitts.
Oh, yeah. Got to leave and say Kitts. I got it. Hey, thanks so much. Back with more of Eye on Travel right after this. Minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you as Ion Travel continues from the Four Seasons Resort on the island of Nevis in the West Indies in the Caribbean. You can always reach me at peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it right here on the air. My next guest I've known for a long time. She has figured out how to do her job in the best location possible. But of course, I knew her when she was back in Atlanta for Four Seasons. She's actually the Regional Vice President and General Manager of the Four Seasons here, Yvette Thomas-Henry. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
So you lucked out.
I certainly think so.
You know, I've been coming here for maybe 25 years. We actually broadcast this show about 15 years ago from here. We did.
Interesting.
We did. And most Americans, I have to say, don't even know where Nevis is.
Very true.
Right?
Very true.
So you have to educate them.
It's a little island. Actually, it's part of the Federation of St. Kitts and Nevis. And if you're flying here from the Northeast, I think the simplest way to get here is probably going through Miami. And you take a three-hour flight, you head to St. Kitts, and then you take a ferry over from St. Kitts to Nevis. So you don't fly in directly to the island of Nevis. You do take a ferry over.
So what you're basically saying, it's part of the adventure.
Absolutely. It's absolutely part of the adventure and a beautiful part of it.
Now, you're originally from the Caribbean.
I am.
From where?
I'm from St. Thomas, and I grew up in St. Croix, the U.S. Virgin Islands. But my mom was born in St. Kitts.
So you've come home.
Yes, I've come home. Yes, quite literally.
What do people not understand about Nevis?
I don't think they understand the beauty of the island. The beauty of the island is really a part of the people, their heart and soul of the people of Nevis, the proud Nevisians who don't want to leave their island. They're committed and tied to it and love it here. And they're not looking to go elsewhere because there's so much natural beauty and there's so much connection to the culture and connection to the family members that are here. And I think their sense of pride that they have, the sense of pride of seeing individuals move through their lives here on the island, move into positions in the resort, because a number of the employees who live here have family members who live here. The pride of seeing them go from one position to the next and also get elevated, that's something that really truly is remarkable to them.
I'm going to make a wild guess that you don't have a lot of turnover here.
We don't have a lot of turnover. No, you're absolutely right. We've been open for 29 years and we have individuals who were here on the opening team that are still with the resort. However, we do have new employees here.
Of course you do. But, yeah. But the bottom line is this is an island where everybody sort of knows everybody.
Everyone is connected here. And it's quite often that I'm speaking to an employee and they say, well, you know my mom or you know my sister, you know my brother. And I'm like, no. And they're like, well, they're in this department. So it is a resort that is filled with families. Literally, when we say we're a family, it really is because we are a family.
What was the biggest surprise for you? Because you came from Atlanta. You've only been here a few months. Even though you were coming home, what was the biggest surprise about this sort of a resort? Because you came from the Four Seasons in Atlanta, which is not really a resort.
No, it is definitely not a resort. The magnitude of this resort, I think, is impressive. We have residential components. We have a golf course. We have tennis courts. We have guest rooms. 84 villas.
You have guest rooms?
We have
guests. At a resort? Let me write that one down.
Incredible, okay. Right? Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, it is not just simply a hotel with guest rooms. We have all sorts of other facets to it. And we have tennis pros and golf pros, all because those are part of this resort as well. So I think the biggest surprise is the vast magnitude. But beyond that, the incredible amount of experience that is here because you have such long-standing employees. You ask a question, you can find out the history. Literally, 29 years of history, someone is here that can explain it to you.
Well, on an island of this size, I think the best way to do it is, I know a guy who knows a guy.
Yes. Yes, and you typically know a guy who knows a guy who you're related to, who's here, and things that happen here really impact the community.
So as opposed to Las Vegas, where what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, what happens here, everybody knows about.
What happens here, everybody knows about it. And when it's something good, it's really broadcast across the resort and across the island. It is not unusual. Actually, it's actually something that's really nice when the premier says, I heard you've had a promotion. Send me the information so I can share it. I mean, it's something that really is meaningful to them when they can see that you don't have to leave the island to grow, to develop, to get further in your career, and certainly to be promoted here at the resort.
Because in travel and tourism, one of the biggest challenges, at least in the United States, is employee retention.
Yes, that is absolutely not our challenge. Our employees want to be here. They love being here. They take great pride in saying that they've worked for Four Seasons and that generations of their family has worked for Four Seasons.
Now, when you were in Atlanta, there you were at the world's biggest airport. You could source anything for that hotel.
Yes.
Anything could be flown in at a moment's notice.
Yes, yes.
Not always the case here.
No, it does take a lot of planning. I mean, we have to be very strategic. You're right. There is no Starbucks, but there's also no Home Depot, and there's nothing here
that's right around the corner. That's a benefit.
Well, in some instances it is. You certainly are then focused on what the beauty and the gems that are here on the island.
But if you're going to order nails, you better order a lot of them.
But if you're going to order something that you need tomorrow, you needed to have ordered it 2 weeks ago so that we can make sure it's gotten from the supplier onto our freight that comes in every week. And so we've got to be very thoughtful and mindful about what we need and ordering it in advance.
So when you first got here, your first response was, I can't get it tomorrow?
Exactly.
No, Yvette, you can't.
That's right. And I had to find out the timing for when the tankers come in and what do we need to do to make sure that we're ordering it in time. Yeah, it's really, truly understanding.
See, the beautiful thing about an island is you judge or you gauge your schedule by when the tanker and the freighter come in.
That's correct. And you also gauge what are the supplies that you need and how long do you need them for. So you're not just ordering for when the freight comes in on Friday. You're ordering enough to take you through for however long length of time that you need it for.
So in April, you're planning for Christmas.
Well, in April, there are certain things that we are absolutely planning for Christmas.
Yeah.
Without a doubt, particularly if it's something that we're going to need from the mainland, the U.S., in order to come here and our vendors need to go there to get it. So yes, we're planning that far in advance. But that means we also have employees who are thinking that far in advance and who know the cycle. To say, okay, if for any reason
you need it, you got to go get it.
Absolutely.
Yvette Thomas-Henry, the Regional Vice President and General Manager right here at the Four Seasons in Nevis. That music means we're out of time for this hour. Stick around, everybody. We have a whole lot more coming as Eye on Travel continues from the island of Nevis and the Four Seasons in the West Indies. If you've been reading the news lately, there's been an explosion in cruise ships, in cruise ship building, in the types of cruise ships that are being built, in the audiences that they're chasing, whether it's Richard Branson and Virgin Cruise, a whole different audience there. River Cruise is still exploding with much more luxury ships. And then most recently, one of the big River Cruise people, Viking, announced that they're joining the pack for luxury expedition ships to go to far-flung destinations where they're basically their own infrastructure and adding a little luxury in the process. Let's talk about that with Cruise Critics Managing Editor Chris Grayfaust. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing good, Peter.
So this is, you know, Viking was interesting because they used to start, you know, they were at a point where they were christening like 10 river boats at a time. And then they started to go back to Torhagen's original routes, which, of course, was cruise liners. And they started, the Viking cruise ships, which would be ocean-going vessels. And now he's entered the luxury expedition ships.
Yeah, that's correct. They've just recently announced that they will be adding two expedition ships to their lineup beginning in 2022. And what's interesting about these ships, they're going to have a lot of the same things that people who like Viking already will enjoy. They're going to have a thermal Nordic spa. They're going to have that same kind of lovely Scandinavian design. But a few things they're doing that are interesting is that for the first time on an expedition ship, really, they're going to have an enclosed marina so that people can get on the Zodiacs and the RIB boats with without being exposed to the elements. So that's kind of something that's a little bit new and
I have to laugh about that. God forbid you should be on a ship and not be exposed to the elements. I mean, isn't that really part of the experience?
Well, there is that, right? I mean, if you're going to go all the way to Antarctica, don't you want a little bit of wind in your hair, for sure? You know, there is that idea. But, you know, we also have to think about the market for these ships. You know, it is people that are a little bit more comfortable in life, right? And so they might be at a point where getting in and out of Zodiacs with a lot of wind buffering them and that kind of thing might be a little difficult. So I think Viking's making it accessible for more people.
I get that. And once again, when you see what's going on with Silver Sea, with National Geographic, with Crystal, everybody's upping the game in that luxury expedition ship business.
Yeah, everybody now wants to go to far-flung places, but they don't want to give up style and comfort. You know, I really think that's what's driving this. In the past, expedition ships used to be a little bit, really more like an adventure. You know, they were kind of not that fancy. You'd feel the water and the waves and that kind of thing. And now people want a little bit more, a more comfortable experience when they're going even to these far-flung places.
Exactly. And the price is not necessarily inexpensive.
No, not at all. These are bucket list trips, there's more of them coming into the market, so we might see the prices come down slightly. We'll have to see how that kind of comes out, because as you're absolutely right, there's a lot of people coming into the market, and as always, when everybody comes in, then there's a lot more competition.
You know, here's the other idea. You know, everybody wants, when you take a look at the real numbers here, and you see this on your end all the time, and that is, the cruise industry is still essentially in its infancy. If you're looking at the evolution of travel, only 30 million people have ever taken a cruise, at least Americans. There are only 365 ships out there around the world. So the upside here is tremendous. They're finding new ports every day that people didn't even know they had ports they're sailing to. And yet the shipyards are building more ships than ever before. Every shipyard is at 100% capacity. So the excess occupancy now, the excess availability in terms of capacity, has got to be a buyer's market.
Yeah, you know, I think what you said about people going to new ports and that kind of thing is very interesting, in that one thing that Viking also is doing is they're taking these expedition ships to the Great Lakes, which on the surface, you know, doesn't always sound necessarily that exciting. I mean, the Great Lakes, you know, the Midwest of America's U.S., you know, Midwest, it's not necessarily where you think of grand adventure. But they're plotting out these itineraries that kind of are giving another look at places like Thunder Bay or Duluth or, again, places that on the surface might not seem like they're expedition-esque, but in fact they're finding UNESCO like bioreserves and nature types of things, and going through the Sioux Locks, a little bit of enrichment they can give people about that kind of history. And so they really are kind of shining a different light on places that people might not have considered cruising to.
You know what I'm waiting for cruises to, and you might even know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you a question, and it's not meant to trap you. I'm actually asking a question of my audience, and here's the question. What's the largest body of water in North America? Do you know?
Is it Lake Superior?
No.
Is it Hudson Bay?
Now you got it. It is
okay,
Hudson
right.
Bay.
I'm glad this is in jeopardy. I would have lost.
No, but you know what? Most people do. They never even get it. You got it on the second guess. The thing is, everybody should listen to this show now and then go get an atlas or a map. Look at the map of North America. You will be astounded at the size of Hudson Bay. It is basically bigger than all the Great Lakes combined, and nobody knows anything about it. I'm waiting for the cruises there.
You know, that's exciting. That would be very exciting. There have been a few cruises that have done that Northwest Passage, you know, going
yes.
way far north, but we haven't really seen the Hudson Bay market really pick up, and I agree with you. That would be fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, that would be great. Now, let's change gears just briefly. You've got Richard Branson coming out in a couple of months with Virgin Cruises. And of course, their model for their audience is no kids. You know, you do what you want. And everybody's going to have fun. I like to call it like Tinder at sea.
Well, we'll see if it's like, I don't know how many people are going to be swiping on the ship. We'll have to see if they enable that. That's a good addition. They should add that.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the first thing. And then Ritz-Carlton's coming on board, although they've been somewhat delayed in the delivery of their ships, with the Ritz-Carlton brand of cruise ships.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing here is that people are eyeing the cruise market. It's exactly what you talked about earlier when you said that there's just not as many people have taken cruises as they have gone on land trips and that kind of thing. The cruise industry is always looking to get new people to take that first cruise, because usually when they take that first cruise, they want to come back. And so you're seeing these different brands come in that have a lot of recognition and loyalty among their customers. And so if you're a Ritz-Carlton loyalist and you love their hotels, and I mean, really, who doesn't, then you are going to love their Ritz-Carlton at Sea. I mean, essentially what they're doing is taking that concept of comfort and luxury and high-end service, and they're bringing it to a ship that's quite, you know, fairly small, so it's more like they're calling it a yacht. And, you know, why wouldn't you want to do that, you know? And likewise, Virgin is looking to have the same kind of excitement that they always had with their different products and kind of that rock star element that Richard Branson brings, and bringing that to Sea. And I think it's going to be really fun to see all the things that they're bringing, like the tattoo parlor at Sea. I'm not quite sure if I'm up for a tattoo at Sea, but we'll see who is.
You know, Chris, we were doing so well until you mentioned that.
No, are you tattoo for
wait,
you,
hold
Peter.
It. Oh, unless there's serious alcohol involved and I have no memory of the incident. But here's the thing. Are you really serious? There's really going to be a tattoo parlor at Sea? Can you imagine buyer's remorse 3,000 miles away from a port?
You know, I'm just not sure how that's going to work in reality, because tattoos, when they're first made, they're not really supposed to be exposed to sun or salt, and that's exactly what you have at Sea. So we'll have to see how that goes.
Oh, my God. You know what? The stories that are going to come out of that, I mean, that's, you know what? I have a mantra, and my mantra is bad decisions make great stories. This qualifies.
And then you'll have it for the rest of your life.
On that one, the parade starts right now. I mean, you know, look, with all due respect to people who have had tattoos, and I do respect those people because it was a personal decision and I can't make a value judgment. However, every time I go to Las Vegas, I find myself sitting in a stationary position near the entrance for at least 30 minutes because it's the best show on earth. Because as everybody walks by, I'm thinking to myself, four words. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
What were you thinking?
I'm sure it's going to be the same way on the ship. I'm sure the seats near the tattoo parlor will be some of the best in the house.
Well, here's the best part of it. You know, and I know, the lawyers are going to get into this, and before you can ever have a tattoo on that ship, you're going to sign a 3-page waiver so that you have no recourse once, you know, you want to put on, you know, your girlfriend's name forever and you're just about to break up, you know. I'm telling you, this is going to be fun. It'll be great. It'll be great theater at Sea. Forget Cirque du Soleil. Forget the Broadway show reviews. Just park yourself in front of the tattoo parlor, have a Corona, and wait for the action. That's it.
I think it's going to be great.
I do too. Chris Grayfoss of Cruise Critic, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here as Ion Travel continues from the island of Nevis in the West Indies at the Four Seasons Resort. So much to talk about here, and they have so many great programs here when you come here, because you're literally up against the water. You can't avoid the water, and by the way, why would you? And if you're not avoiding the water, then you're going to hang out with my next guest. He's the unofficial turtle liaison guy. You know, earlier in the show, we talked to Yvette, the general manager, about long-term employees. Ignacio Otley is one of those. He's been about 20 years, I believe. But he is the actual unofficial turtle liaison guy, and every year when the scientists come to tag the turtles, guests here can actually get in there and do it. Ignacio, welcome.
Thank you.
So what exactly happens when they do that?
Okay, it's a joint program with the Worldwide Turtle Conservancy Program with the Four Seasons Resort Nevis, where we get transmitters and tag the turtles, and we monitor their movements and create more awareness to the people.
And how long does that take?
Sometimes it can take you all night. Sometimes we've been like out at 9 in the evening, come back 4 in the morning. So you have to be persistent.
But it takes place for a week?
Yes. Sometimes, yeah, we do it for the weekend, normally around July time. Yes.
And anybody can participate?
Anyone. It's open to all. And on the Four Seasons website, we will put out the advertisements as well.
But the other thing is kids can get involved too.
Of course.
That's the fun part.
Yes. And the kids can actually name the turtles. And we have contests where you name the turtles as well. And that will be posted online.
Okay. What's the strangest name the turtle ever got?
Well, I know we had Coco.
Coco the turtle. Fine. Yeah. But you've been doing this how long?
Here for quite a long time. I've been doing it over as much as I can remember. It's quite a long time.
And what have you learned about the tagging of the turtles? What are they actually teaching you?
Okay, at least when you're doing this, we use like a resin on the back of it, but it won't harm them as well. And we see their different movements to different places, and sometimes it's amazing to come back to the same beach.
They've got a sort of inherent radar.
Yes.
Or sonar, I should say.
And actually, yes, and you can actually track them online.
Oh, that's the cool thing. So that's great for the kids, too, because when they go back home and they've named their turtle, they're following the turtle.
Yes, you can go on conserveturtles.org, and that's the Turtle Conservancy website, and you will get it there.
Not bad. Do you have a favorite turtle?
All of them. It's fun. Once I'm there, I'm having fun.
And the thing is, just don't prepare a regular daytime schedule or a nighttime schedule. Yeah. It's when the turtles show up.
Yes.
The turtles show up.
Yeah. So you may be there, you have mosquitoes biting you, so you don't worry about that.
Oh, it's part of the experience.
Yes.
But at least you're giving the warning.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you're also a poet.
Yes, I do.
When did you start doing that?
Well, since I was little, I loved it a bit. But we used to have like a DJ system. I used to be shy. I used to be in the background. I would just write a little dub, but I won't come on the microphone.
You're on the microphone now.
Yeah, I got a little brave over the years, and I went by a local spot, and they were there, so I did something. And if I was shaking at the time, but I did not stutter, and then I just kept on doing it.
So do you have a poem for me now?
Yes, I do.
All right, Ignacio Utley and Queen of the Caribbean, go.
Okay. Welcome to Nevis, Queen of the Caribbeans. Beautiful sandy beaches and tropical fruit trees. The most genuine, friendliest people that you'll ever meet. It don't take much effort, but we'll sweep you clean off your feet. Before I proceed, we'll exceed your expectations and every needs. We are simple, loving, caring human beings. Easily accessed via air and sea. Everyone, Nevis is the place to be. We are 36 square miles with 5 parishes, approximate population of 12,000 pieces, people, and traditional finger-licking dishes. A taste of our meals, you might even eat the utensils. But if you'd like to, we can create edible stencils. Exotic beaches, coconut and palm trees. Relax on the beach. Drink some killer bees. Mountain biking, horseback riding, deep sea fishing, liming, snorkeling, scuba diving, romantic dining. The island's very inviting. That's just a few. Even hiking and mountain climbing. Our highest point is called Nevis Peak. It's 3,232 feet high. So refreshing being amidst the clouds in the sky. It's warm and sunny with tropical cool breeze. Relax under a tree. Put your mind at ease. Nevis is friendly for all ages, but numerous people come here and wound up making babies. Attractable and enchanting, but very irresistible. You'll never hear the word impossible. Get engaged, then beach weddings. We ensure you leave with happy endings, but I'd say it's the start of new beginnings. There's so much to do and say, but you'll experience on your stay. So much joy you'll have in less than half a day. Our prestigious resorts and hotels are very accommodating. Not just the facilities, but impeccable service you'll be receiving. Once you're here, you won't even think about leaving. Nevis nice and very relievable. You gotta try some local drinks when you're here. A few are Ting Jinxing Up and Carib. That's the real man's beer. Not because I'm good at words, I won't sugarcoat. But you know the feeling when someone rock your boat. Any former guests I know can attest. I'm sure they'll tell you that Nevis and its people are simply the best. Thank you.
Ignacio Utley, who's done the impossible because he found a word to rhyme with utensils. That was the one. You found a word to rhyme. Hey, if you're coming to the resort here at the Four Seasons, check out Ignacio. He is your turtle guide. He's your turtle concierge. And if you like, he'll even write a poem for you. Ignacio, thanks for joining us. Hey, that music means you're out of time for the entire show. Lots of people to thank. Dara Stone, Alessandra B., Jeff Ryder, Mitchell Nova, and the entire staff here at the Four Seasons of Nevis. We'll see you next week, everybody, from another resort, remote location, spa, bowling alley, or whatever, somewhere around the world. Bye-bye, everybody. Hey, Prime members, Peter Greenberg here. You can listen to Eye on Travel ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, and you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. And before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at Wondery.com.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Survivor's back, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. And we have a twist, a new co-host, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
Hi!
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.